Ambassador William Taylor and State Department official George Kent have returned to the hearing room and taken their seats now at the witness table so they can be questioned by the Republican ranking member Devin Nunes and his staff attorney, which does give these hearings a bit of a different feel instead of the constant grandstanding back and forth by the politicians, a rather workmanlike case being built for either side by the staff attorneys that are questioning both Kent and Taylor, who are just now taking their seats after standing at the witness table. House staff members are clearing photographers out of the way so this hearing can resume. Another 45-minute block of questions for the two diplomats, this time from Republican ranking member Devin Nunes and his staff attorney, as Chairman Schiff prepares to gavel the committee back to order.
We'll come back to order. The chair now recognizes the ranking member and minority counsel for 45 minutes.
Thank you. The call summary for which the Democrats want to impeach President Trump is dramatically different from their nefarious depiction of it. What it actually shows is a pleasant exchange between two leaders who discuss mutual cooperation over a range of issues. The Democrats claim this call demonstrates extortion, bribery, and a host of other monstrous crimes being committed against President Zelensky. Yet President Zelensky himself insists there was nothing improper whatsoever about the conversation. Indeed, the routine nature of the call helps to explain why, in this committee's last public hearing, Democrats recited a fictitious version of the call instead of reading the actual transcript. The Democrats depicted the president saying, quote, "I want you to make up dirt on my political opponent, understand? Lots of it, on this and on that," unquote. The transcript did not show President Trump saying anything remotely like that. The president did not ask Ukraine to make up dirt on anyone. But the Democrats are not trying to discover facts. They're trying to invent a narrative. And if the facts they need do not exist, then they'll just make it up. Not only does President Zelensky deny the Democrats' characterization of the call, but as Ambassador Taylor testified to this committee, the Ukrainians did not even know at the time of the call that a temporary delay was put on the security assistance for them. Furthermore, as the ambassador testified, these holds occur from time to time. Both he and Ambassador Volker were confident the delay would be lifted. And in fact, military aid to Ukraine has actually substantially improved since President Trump took office. Ambassador Taylor testified that President Trump was the first president to see that Ukraine was afforded Javelin anti-tank weapons. This was a very strong message that Americans are willing to provide more than blankets. This was the Obama administration's approach. Note this important fact. The security assistance was provided to Ukraine without the Ukrainians having done any of the things they were supposedly being blackmailed to do. So we're supposed to believe that President Trump committed a terrible crime that never actually occurred and which the supposed victim denies ever happened. I'd like to briefly speak about the core mistruth at the heart of the Democrats' impeachment drive. They claim the president tried to get the Ukrainians to, quote, manufacture dirt against his political rivals. This is supported by precisely zero evidence. Once again, the Democrats simply made it up. But let's consider the broader question about why President Trump may have wanted answers to questions about Ukraine meddling in 2016. The Democrats downplay, ignore, or outright deny the many indications that Ukrainians actually did meddle in the election, a shocking about-face for people who for 3 years argued that foreign election meddling was an intolerable crime that threatened the heart of our democracy. While the brazen suddenness of this U-turn is jarring, this denial is a necessary part of their argument. After all, if there actually were indications of Ukraine election meddling, and if foreign election meddling is a dire threat, then President Trump would have a perfectly good reason for wanting to find out what happened. And since the meddling was aimed against his campaign, he'd have good reason for sending his personal attorney to make inquiries about it. What's strange is that some of the witnesses at these hearings and previous depositions who express alarm about these inquiries were remarkably uninformed about these indications of Ukrainian election meddling and why the president may have been concerned by them. For example, I noted previously, Alexander Chalupa, a former staffer for the Democratic National Committee, admitted to Politico that she worked with officials at the Ukrainian embassy in Washington, D.C. to dig up dirt on the Trump campaign, which she passed on to the DNC and the Hillary Clinton campaign. Chalupa revealed that Ukrainian embassy officials themselves were also working directly with reporters to trade information and leads about the Trump campaign. Ambassador Kent, you didn't seem to be too concerned about it in the last round of questioning, so I'll just skip you because we know that wasn't a concern. But Ambassador Taylor, you testified to this committee that you only recently became aware of reports of this cooperation between Ukrainian embassy officials and Chalupa to undermine the Trump campaign from your last deposition. Is that correct?
Mr. Nunes, it is correct that I had not known about this before.
That's, I'm just going over your last deposition.
That's exactly right.
Ambassador.
Yep.
The Politico article cites three named Ukrainian officials asserting that the Ukrainian embassy supported the Hillary Clinton campaign. It quotes Ukrainian parliamentarian Andrei Artemenko saying, quote, "It was clear they were supporting Hillary Clinton's candidacy. They did everything from organizing meetings with the Clinton team to publicly supporting her to criticizing Trump. I think that they simply didn't meet with the Trump campaign because they thought Hillary would win," unquote. Ambassador Taylor, you testified you were unfamiliar with that statement. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You also said you were unaware that then Ukrainian ambassador to the U.S., Valerie Chalet, wrote an op-ed in the Hill during the 2016 presidential campaign criticizing then-candidate Trump. Is that correct?
That is correct.
You said you did not know that Sergei Lyshenko, then a Ukrainian parliamentarian, had admitted that part of his motivation in spreading information about the so-called Black Ledger, a disputed document purporting to reveal corruption by a former Trump campaign official, was to undermine the Trump's candidacy. This was in your deposition. Is that still correct?
That is still correct, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Fusion GPS contractor Nellie Orr testified to Congress that Lyshenko was a source for Fusion GPS's operation to dirty up the Trump campaign, including the compilation of the Steele dossier on behalf of the DNC and the Clinton campaign. You testified you were unaware that Lyshenko served as a source for that project. Ambassador Taylor, is this still correct?
It is, sir.
You said you did not know that Ukrainian Internal Affairs Minister Arsen Avakov mocked and disparaged then-candidate Trump on Facebook and Twitter. Is that still correct?
That is correct.
Ambassador Taylor, in your testimony to this committee, you said you were never briefed on these reports and statements, that you did not do due diligence before taking your post to discover that the president's and Mayor Giuliani's concerns may have been, and that you did what they may have been, and that you did not discuss them with Ambassador Yovanovitch. That's still correct?
Yes, sir.
Furthermore, you said it upset you to hear about the many indications of Ukrainian election meddling. Your precise words were, I'm going to read them back to you, "Based on this political article, which again surprises me, disappoints me, because I think it's a mistake for any diplomat or government official in one country to interfere in the political life of another. That's disappointing," unquote. Pastor Taylor, is that still your testimony?
Mr. Nunes, it is. Subsequent to that, I looked into the circumstances for several of the things that you just mentioned. In 2016, candidate Trump had made a statement saying that it was possible that he would allow Crimea to go back to Russia. He expressed the sentiment or the opinion that it was possible that Crimea wanted to go back to Russia. What I can tell you, Ms. Nunes, is that that sentiment is amazingly inflammatory to all Ukrainians. So
I can understand that. Are you aware during the, I believe it was the 2012 election when at the time President Obama leaned over on a hot mic to the then Russian president and said that he'd have to wait till after the election? Was that inflammatory to the Ukrainians also?
I don't know, sir.
I just want to be clear that some government officials opposed President Trump's approach to Ukraine, but many had no idea what concerned him. In this case, it was numerous indications of Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election to oppose his campaign and support Hillary Clinton. Once you know that, it's easy to understand the president's desire to get to the bottom of this corruption and to discover exactly what happened in the 2016 election. And with that, I'll turn to Mr. Castor.
Ambassador Taylor, Mr. Kent, President Trump's concerns about Ukraine's role in the 2016 election, you believe he genuinely believed they were working against him, right, Ambassador Taylor?
Mr. Castor, I don't know what President or candidate Trump was thinking about the Ukrainians.
I mean, didn't he in this Oval Office meeting on May 23rd after the Zelensky inauguration, didn't he lament that the Ukrainians were out to get him?
I heard that his response to the suggestion that Mr. Zelensky visit Mr. Trump, President Trump, in the Oval Office was not well received, and that he had concerns about Ukrainians, yes.
But from the president's perspective, if the ambassador, Ukrainian ambassador to the United States, one of the most influential diplomats, is penning an op-ed, certainly with the okay of President Poroshenko, the DNC consultants are conferring with Ukrainian officials at the embassy. Former Prime Minister Yatsenyuk is saying things on social media. Interior Minister Avakov, who has spanned both the Poroshenko and the Zelensky realm, is also saying some very unkind things on social media about the president. You certainly can appreciate that President Trump was very concerned that some elements of the Ukrainian establishment were not in favor of him, did not support him, and were out to get him.
If I go to, and I'll allow the question, but
parliamentary inquiry, are you seriously interrupting our time here?
I will allow the question. I won't dock this from the time. I just want to be clear, Ambassador, if you're able to verify the things that counsel has asked you in the prerequisite of the question, that's fine. Otherwise, in questions from the majority or the minority that may assume facts not in evidence before you, you should be cautioned about that.
Mr. Chairman, point of order.
The time is with with minority counsel.
Mr. Ratcliffe.
Chairman, I sat here through the first 45 minutes and literally had an objection to almost the foundation of every question that Mr. Goldman asked regarding facts not in evidence, leading. But House Resolution 660 does not say that we are under the federal rules of evidence. If it is your position that I should be asserting objections to questions that violate the federal rules of evidence, let me know now, because this hearing is going to change significantly.
As I said, Mr. Ratcliffe, I will allow the question.
I think the gentleman has a different question about the rules. So what are the rules that are going to govern this?
Does the ranking member seek recognition?
I'm asking, I'm yielding you to a question I just asked you.
For what purpose do you seek recognition?
To answer Mr. Ratcliffe's question.
I have answered it. You may resume your question.
Respectfully, Mr. Chairman, you haven't answered my question whether or not I should be asserting assumes facts not in evidence or leading objections to questions that are posed from this point forward. That's my question.
Mr. Ratcliffe, I'll say once again, I'm not objecting to the question, but I am instructing the witness that they should not presume questions from the majority or the minority that may represent facts not in evidence are correct. I have answered the question. We will resume the questioning and resume the clock.
Mr. Castor.
So you certainly can appreciate President Trump's concerns.
Ms. Castor, I don't know the exact nature of President Trump's concerns. In my deposition, I recall you handed me the Politico article, which listed at least three of the elements that you have described earlier. And you've recognized, and I have confirmed with the ranking minority member, that this first I'd heard of those and was surprised by those. I don't know President Trump's reaction to those.
In the information published by Sergei Leshchenko, former Ukrainian investigative journalist, and then he was a member of the parliament, about the Manafort black ledgers in August of 2016. The very day that was published, Mr. Manafort resigned from the campaign, correct?
I don't know, Mr. Castor.
But certainly that gives rise to some concern that there are elements of the Ukrainian establishment that were out to get the president. That's a very reasonable belief of his. Correct?
I don't know.
The run-up to the 2016 election, there's many facts that remain unresolved. Agreed?
I'm sorry, what's the question?
There are many facts relating to the run-up of the 2016 election that remain unresolved.
Any further?
Well, Attorney General Barr in May of 2019 tasked the U.S. Attorney for Connecticut, John Durham, to broadly examine the government's collection of intelligence involving the president's campaign. That effort, initially was an administrative review, has turned into a criminal probe. And U.S. Attorney Durham is casting a wide net and is following the facts where they may lead. Are you aware of that?
I'm aware that there is an investigation. That's as much as I'm aware.
And so to the extent any information resides in Ukraine, it's perfectly appropriate for the Ukrainians to try to get to the bottom of that, for the Ukrainians to cooperate with the United States through official channels to share that information, correct?
Ms. Kessler, can you say that one again? I'd appreciate it if you would restate the question.
To the extent Ukraine has facts related to the run-up of the 2016 election that are under the U.S. Attorney Durham's probe, Ukraine should cooperate with the United States, and to the extent there are Ukrainians doing improper things, the Ukrainians ought to investigate that themselves, correct?
Ms. Kessler, the Ukrainian-American relations are very supportive. The Ukrainians will certainly be responsive to requests.
So when the president on the call transcript of July 25th raises this with President Zelensky, and he urges that there be a connection between the Ukrainian government and the Justice Department officially, I mean, that's the appropriate way to raise an issue with the Ukrainian president, correct?
It's appropriate for the Justice Department and the Prosecutor General to cooperate and to exchange information, yes.
But to the extent the president has concerns and to the extent the Attorney General is having the U.S. Attorney Durham look into that, isn't it entirely appropriate for the president to flag this for President Zelensky and say that you should be in touch with our official channels?
Ms. Kessler, I don't know the precise appropriateness of these kinds of relations.
Now, were you involved, either of you involved with the preparation for the 725 call?
I was not.
I was not.
And how do you account for that? I mean, you are the two of the key officials with responsibility for the Ukrainian policy. If the President of the United States is going to have a call with the leader of Ukraine, why wouldn't you ordinarily be involved with
the preparation?
Sir, we work for the Department of State in an embassy overseas, and in preparation for a presidential phone call, that responsibility lies with the staff of the National Security Council. Normally, if there is enough sufficient time, National Security staff can solicit information, usually from the State Department, and we can draw on the embassy, but that's only background information, and my understanding, having never worked at the National Security Council, is that National Security staff write a memo to the President, and none of us see that outside of the National Security staff.
Okay, so the chargé or the U.S. ambassador to the country wouldn't ordinarily be on a call with a foreign leader?
That's correct. Would not.
And did Colonel Vindman or anyone at the National Security Council staff reach out to you, Mr. Kent, in preparation for the call?
I was given notification the day before on July 24th, and to the extent I had any role, it was to reach out to the embassy, give them a heads up, and ask them to ensure that the secure communications link in the Office of the President of Ukraine was functional so the call could be patched through from the White House Situation Room.
Did you provide any substantive advice to Colonel Vindman about the call and what ought to be the official position?
I was not asked, and I did not provide.
Okay. Same with you, Ambassador?
The same.
And the call was scheduled, you know, you testified earlier that the call was on again, off again. And after the July 10th meeting with Ambassador Bolton, the consensus was the call was not going to happen. Is that correct?
I would not say that was a consensus. The State Department's position was that a call between the two presidents would be useful. Mm-hmm. And once Zelensky's party won the first ever absolute majority in parliamentary elections on July 21st, the idea of a congratulatory call made eminent sense from our perspective.
Okay, and the call was scheduled. And did you get a readout, Ambassador Taylor, initially from the call?
I didn't, Ms. Kessler. We all read the statement that the Ukrainians put out. I got a readout several days later from Mr. Morrison, National Security Council.
Okay. And how about you, Mr. Kent?
I likewise first saw the Ukrainian statement, and I believe the next day, July 26th, which would have been a Friday, I did get a partial readout from Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, yes.
Ambassador Taylor, you said that the Ukrainian readout was cryptic. Is that just because it's initially written in Ukrainian and translated to the U.S.?
No, it's, as a general rule, both the United States and other countries, including Ukraine, will put out very short summaries that kind of hit the highlights of the discussion, but without going into detail.
Okay. And you mentioned it was cryptic. Why did you think it was cryptic?
Knowing now what, having read the transcript and looking back at their summary, mm-hmm. As I recall, and I don't recall the exact words, but they said that there were issues to be pursued in order to improve relations between the two countries or something like that.
That seems pretty ordinary.
It seems pretty ordinary.
You were with President Zelensky the very next day?
We were. We had a meeting with him the very next day.
And did President Zelensky raise any concerns about his views of the call?
He said, I... Ambassador Volker, Ambassador Sondland were in his office, and we asked him, I think, how the call. He said the call was fine. I was happy with the call.
Okay. And did you get any additional readouts subsequently about the call? Like, when did you first learn that the call contained things that concerned you? Was that not until September 25th?
Morrison, as I say, briefed me several days later, before the end of July, and I think this is where I said in my testimony that he said it could have gone better, and he said it mentioned that the call mentioned Mr. Giuliani. Mm-hmm. He also said that the call mentioned the former ambassador. Both of those were concerning.
Giuliani was first raised on the call by President Zelensky, correct?
I don't recall.
Okay.
It could have been. Well, I have it here if you'd like to check.
Yeah, it's on page.
Very good.
Page three. The first mention of Giuliani is from President Zelensky, and it's on page three. And President Zelensky says, I will personally tell you that one of my assistants spoke with Mr. Giuliani just recently, and we are hoping very much that Mr. Giuliani will be able to travel to Ukraine, and we will meet once he comes to Ukraine. Did that surprise you?
Again, I didn't have the transcript at the time. All I heard was that Giuliani was mentioned. Mr. Morrison said that Giuliani was mentioned in the call.
But the way Zelensky states it here, it sounds like he is very much looking forward to speaking with America's mayor.
That's what I found out when I read the transcript on the 25th of September or so.
Okay. Now, Mr. Kent, corruption in Ukraine is endemic, correct?
That's correct.
And it affects the courts, the prosecutors, and there have historically been problems with all the prosecutors in Ukraine, correct?
I would say up until the new set of prosecutors appointed by President Zelensky in the last 2 months, correct.
Okay, and so the U.S. government, the consensus hope at the State Department and the National Security Council and the White House is that Zelensky's the real deal. He's a real reformer. He's genuinely interested in rooting out corruption, prosecuting the bad guys, correct?
I would say we are cautiously optimistic, and we will work wherever there is the political will to do the right thing and put forward genuine reform.
And at the heart of the corruption is this oligarchical system, correct? Where the oligarchs take control, often by a virtual theft of, for example, the right to certain energy licenses, correct?
That is one element, yes, sir.
And the company Burisma, its leader, Zochevsky, he has a little bit of a storied history of corruption, doesn't he?
Mr. Zochevsky was Minister of Energy from 2010 to 2012 under the pro-Russian government, and he used his regulatory authority to award gas exploration licenses to companies that he himself controlled. That would be considered an act of corruption, in my view, yes.
And certainly self-dealing.
Certainly self-dealing and self-enriching.
And how did the Ukrainian government ultimately pursue that?
In the spring of 2014, the Ukrainian government, the new government after the Revolution of Dignity, turned to partners, particularly the U.S. and the U.K., to try to recover tens of billions of dollars of stolen assets. The first case that we tried to recover that money came from Mr. Zlochevsky. The Serious Crimes Office in the U.K. had already opened up an investigation. They worked with us and the Ukrainian authorities to develop more information. The $23 million was frozen until somebody in the General Prosecutor's Office of Ukraine shut the case, issued a letter to his lawyer, and that money went poof.
So essentially paid a bribe to make the case go away.
That is our strong assumption, yes, sir.
Okay. Now, at any point in time, has anyone in the Ukrainian government tried to reinvestigate that, or did those crimes just go unpunished, and was he free to go?
Mr. Zlochevsky spent time, as far as I understand, in Moscow and Monaco after he fled Ukraine. We continued to raise as a point of order that because U.S. taxpayer dollars had been used to try to recover frozen assets, that we have a fiduciary responsibility, and we continued to press Ukrainian officials to answer for why alleged corrupt prosecutors had closed a case. And we have, till now, not gotten a satisfactory answer. So, to summarize, we thought that Mykola Zlochevsky had stolen money. We thought a prosecutor had taken a bribe to shut the case, and those were our main concerns.
And are you in favor of that matter being fully investigated and prosecuted?
I think since U.S. taxpayer dollars were wasted, I would love to see the Ukrainian Prosecutor General's office find who the corrupt prosecutor was that took the bribe and how much it was paid. And that's what I said to the Deputy Prosecutor General on February 3rd, 2015.
But in addition to prosecuting the person that took the bribes, shouldn't the organization or individual that sponsored the bribes be prosecuted?
I would agree that the Ukrainian law authorities should uphold the rule of law and hold people account for breaking Ukrainian law.
So this company, Burisma, involved in lots of criminal activity, correct?
I do not know that.
But over the years, it's been involved in a number of questionable dealings, correct?
I would say that it's the largest private gas producer in the country, and its business reputation is mixed.
So to the extent a new regime is coming in under President Zelensky, it certainly would be fair for the new prosecutor, a genuine prosecutor, to reexamine old crimes that hadn't sufficiently been brought to justice, right?
I believe that the new Prosecutor General, Ruslan Rybashapka, made a statement to that end that they would be reviewing past cases. But keep in mind, this is a country where those that commit crimes generally never get held to account, so there's a lot to review.
Okay, now this, the bribe was paid in what year?
To the best of my knowledge, the case against Zlochevsky, the former minister, was shut down in December of 2014.
Okay. And right around that time, Burisma starts adding officials to its board. Is that correct?
Understanding is, yes, that Zlochevsky invited a series of new individuals to join the board in 2014.
And do you know what his strategy was in adding officials to his board?
I have never met Mr. Zlochevsky.
Okay. And who are some of the folks he added to the board?
The most prominent person he added to the board was the former president of Poland, Aleksander Kwaśniewski.
And anyone else?
There were a number of others, including some Americans, and the most prominent one in this context is Hunter Biden.
Okay, so Hunter Biden's added to the board of Burisma. Now, do you think that creates a problem that Burisma may be adding people to its board for protection purposes?
Sir, I work for the government. I don't work in the corporate sector, and so I believe that companies build their boards with a variety of reasons, not only to promote their business plans.
Was Hunter Biden a corporate governance expert?
I have no idea what Hunter Biden studied at university or what his CV says.
Mike, is he the Jeffrey Sonnenfeld of the Ukraine?
I have no awareness or knowledge of what his background was and what he may have done on the border.
Okay, so you don't know whether he has any business experience in Ukraine prior to joining Burisma's board?
I've heard nothing about prior experience.
Okay,
no.
Do you know if he speaks Ukrainian?
I do not.
Do you know if he possesses any other element other than the fact that he is the son of, at the time, the sitting vice president?
I do not.
Okay. Ambassador Taylor, do you know whether Hunter Biden offers anything other than the fact that his dad's the former vice president?
I don't.
Or at the time was the vice president?
I have no knowledge of Hunter Biden.
But you would agree it raises questions, right? He was getting paid, I think, $50,000 a month to sit on the board. Did you know if he relocated to Ukraine?
I'm sorry, Mr. Kessler, say again.
Do you know if Hunter Biden relocated to Ukraine?
No knowledge.
Do you know, Mr. Kent?
Again, no knowledge.
Okay. So he's getting paid $50,000 a month, but we don't know whether he had any experience, he had any, he spoke the language, or whether he moved to Ukraine, correct?
Correct.
Now, at this time, Vice President Biden was taking a specific interest in Ukraine, wasn't he?
He was.
And could you tell us about that?
I believe while he was vice president, he made a total of 6 visits to Ukraine. One may have been during the old regime, Yanukovych, and that would make 5 visits after the Revolution of Dignity, which started February of 2014.
Okay, and you were the DCM, the deputy chief of mission at the time, correct?
Starting in 2015, yes.
Okay, and did Vice President Biden come when you were at post?
He did not. I came back for Ukrainian language training, and so I missed several visits.
Now, you've seen Vice President Biden's, he's sort of given a speech, and he's, a little folksy about how he went into Ukraine, and he told the Ukrainians that if they don't fire the prosecutor, they're going to lose their $1 billion in loan guarantees. You've seen that, correct?
I have. I think it was a speech at the Council of Foreign Relations in January 2018.
Right. And he also said that he's been there, Ukraine 13 times. Do you know if that's accurate?
To the best of my knowledge, when he was vice president, he made 6 visits.
And did the State Department ever express any concerns to the vice president's office that the vice president's role at the time in engaging on Ukraine presented any issues?
No, the vice president's role was critically important. It was top cover to help us pursue our policy agenda.
Okay, but given Hunter Biden's role in Burisma's board of directors, at some point you testified in your deposition that you expressed some concern to the vice president's office. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And what did they do about that concern that you expressed?
I have no idea. I reported my concern to the office of the vice president.
Okay, and that was the end of it? Nobody...
You would have to ask people who worked in the office of the vice president during 2015.
But after you expressed the concern of a perceived conflict of interest, at least, the vice president's engagement in Ukraine didn't decrease, did it?
Correct, because the vice president was promoting U.S. policy objectives in Ukraine.
And Hunter Biden's role on the board of Burisma didn't cease, did it?
To the best of my knowledge, it didn't, and my concern was that there was the possibility of a perception of a conflict of interest.
Now, Ambassador Taylor, I want to turn to the discussion of the irregular channel you described. And in fairness, this irregular channel of diplomacy, it's not as outlandish as it could be. Is that correct?
It's not as outlandish as it could be. Yeah, I agree, Mr. Bass.
Okay, we have Ambassador Volker, who's a former Senate-confirmed ambassador to NATO, long-time State Department diplomat, and you've known Ambassador Volker for years, correct?
That's correct.
A man of unquestioned integrity, correct?
That's correct.
And somebody with incredible knowledge of the region.
With very good knowledge of the region. Yes.
And the best interests of the United States?
Yeah, I'm sure that's right.
And the best interests of Ukraine?
His first priority is clearly the United States.
Okay.
And to the extent that Ukraine has an implication for that, yes.
Okay.
Ukraine as well.
And the second member of the irregular channel is Ambassador Sondland, who is Senate-confirmed, ambassador to the EU. So his involvement here, while not necessarily part of his official duties as the ambassador to the EU, it certainly is not outlandish for him to be interested and engaged pursuant to the president or Secretary Pompeo's direction. Correct?
It's a little unusual for the U.S. ambassador to the EU to play a role in Ukraine policy.
Okay. And, you know, it might be irregular, but it's certainly not outlandish. And then Secretary Perry is the third member of the irregular channel, certainly a Senate-confirmed official, somebody with deep experience in energy markets, and he was pursuing some liquefied natural gas projects in Ukraine?
That's correct, Ms. Kessler.
So his involvement, Secretary Perry's involvement, is perfectly acceptable?
It is.
Okay. Now, this irregular channel as it developed, when did you determine that it became problematic? I mean, you in your opening statement identified yourself appropriately as the leader of the regular channel.
At least a participant. There's another leader of the regular channel.
So when did you first develop concerns that the irregular channel was being problematic?
So I arrived in Kyiv in mid-September. By late September, a couple of phone calls with...
You arrived in Kyiv in June, right?
June. Sorry.
June 17th?
Mid-June.
Yeah.
June 17th. Thank you. And so by the end of June, I had begun to hear references to investigations. Mm-hmm. As something that would have to happen prior to the meeting that President Trump had offered to President Zelensky.
Okay.
And that began to raise questions for me.
Okay. Now you've known Ambassador Volker, and you certainly have a reason to know Ambassador Sondland. What did you do at this point, or did you ever try to wrest control of the irregular channel?
I didn't try to wrest control of the irregular channel do that. At the time when
Why not though?
Because Ms. Kessler, at the time as Ambassador Kent, Deputy Assistant Secretary Kent testified, both channels, both channels were interested in having a meeting between President Zelensky and President Trump. So there's no reason to kind of wrest control if we're going in the same direction.
But at some point, you developed concerns. I mean, your opening statement is here. I mean, you're the impeachment witness number one, and you're number two, Mr. Kent. You know, for the case impeaching the President of the United States because of the concerns you've testified about the irregular channel, correct?
I was concerned when the irregular channel appeared to be going against the irregular channel was going against the overall direction of and purpose of the regular channel.
So and as yes. I understand the record, however, you when you arrived in Ukraine, you had the support of the secretary and the secretary's top advisor, Chancellor Ulrich Brechbuhl, correct?
That is correct.
And they assured you that if you had any concerns, you would be able to contact them and they would have your back.
That is correct.
And you knew going in that the Rudy Giuliani element presented some complexities, correct?
I was concerned about Rudy Giuliani's statements and involvement in the Ukraine policy, yes.
Okay. So when it genuinely became, you know, a concern for you, what did you do to either engage Sondland and Volker and Perry, Giuliani? By the way, have you ever met Rudy Giuliani during these times relevant?
Not during the times relevant. Mr. Giuliani visited Ukraine one time when I was there, I think in 2007 or 8.
Okay.
That's the only time I've met him.
Okay. So you've never had any communications with Rudy Giuliani as part of these irregular channel business?
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay. And anyway, getting back to my question, did you try to engage Brechbuhl or the secretary during this time period? I know you said that you had, I believe, an August 21st or 22nd telephone call with Brechbuhl. You had a July 10th telephone call with Brechbuhl, and then you sent a first-person cable to the secretary on August 29th?
That is correct.
Is that sort of the universe of initiatives you took inside the State Department to raise your concerns about the irregular channel?
I also raised my concerns with Deputy Assistant Secretary George Kent. In particular, early on when I think I may have mentioned this phone call that was odd in that it did not include the normal staff, indeed, Ambassador Sondland's staff, and that struck me as unusual. I consulted with Mr. Kent, and at his suggestion made a note of this, and also had, I think at that point, I had a conversation with Mr. Brechbuhl.
That was a June 28th call, I believe?
That's correct.
And in your opening statement, you expressed some concerns about what Ambassador Sondland had said, but then once Zelensky got on the phone, it proceeded in a very regular channel way, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So the June 28th call, at least in and of itself, didn't ultimately, as it played out, present any problems for you?
The call with President Zelensky did not. The preparation for that call, the preparation included maybe 15 minutes of just the Americans that would stay on the call.
Right.
And that, again, that was a little irregular in that it didn't have the staff. It was also in that pre-call, in that 15 minutes before President Zelensky got on the phone, where Ambassador Volker told the rest of the participants that he was planning to have a conversation with President Zelensky in Toronto in 3 days, 4 days, where he would outline for President Zelensky the important components of the phone call that we were trying to establish.
Okay. And you didn't have any issue with that, did you?
The only issue I had with that, Mr. Kessler, was there was reference to investigations in, I believe that's, I'll have to check my notes on that, but there was raised issues for me that I didn't understand what Ambassador Volker had in mind that he was specifically going to raise with Mr. Zelensky. But that was a little bit of a concern.
Okay. I mean, the president's expressed his, you know, interest in certain investigations, certainly relating to the 2016 election and relating to, you know, this corrupt Burisma outfit. So that wasn't inconsistent with the president's message, right?
I'm not sure, Mr. Cashman. Maybe can I ask you to repeat the question?
The president's concerns about the 2016 election and needing to get to the bottom of it, and the president's concerns, is it ultimately related to the Burisma company? I mean, if Ambassador Volker is raising that with Zelensky, that's consistent with the direction of the president, correct?
The president's interest, or I would say Mr. Giuliani's interest, because that's what we were, that's what was very clear at the time. Mr. Giuliani's interest in pursuing these investigations was of concern, but...
By the way, do you know how many times Volker met with Giuliani?
I don't.
How many would you guess? Is it, like, was he talking to him all the time or meeting with him all the time?
Mr. Kessler, I don't know.
Okay. From his, his deposition, he told us just once. And, you know, he texted back and forth with the mayor, and it had a call or two, but it wasn't a pervasive engagement for Ambassador Volker. Were you aware of that?
I was not aware. I was aware of one breakfast, I think, but that's the only one that I was aware of.
And Mr. Kent, before my time expires, I want to circle back to the company of Burisma. And you testified at your deposition that there was an instance where USAID had engaged with Burisma and possibly sponsoring a program, and you took issue with that and recommended USAID to pull back from that. Could you tell us about that?
So I became aware in the summer, I believe, of 2016 that as a part of what I recall was a clean energy awareness campaign, the part of the USAID mission that worked on economics and governance, including energy, had sponsored some sort of contest for young Ukrainians to come up with a theme, and there was a prize. I believe it may have been a camera. And they had co-sponsored, and with public-private partnership being a buzzword, having a co-sponsorship with Burisma. Given the past history of our interest in recovering stolen assets from Zlochevsky, it was my view that it was inappropriate for the embassy to be co-sponsoring a contest with Burisma. I raised that with the mission director at the embassy. She agreed, and the USAID mission kept the contest but dropped the public-private partnership sponsorship.
The time of the gentleman has expired. We'll now move to five-minute member rounds. I recognize myself for 5 minutes. Mr. Kent, I want to follow up on my colleague's questions regarding Burisma. You testified about a time when an oligarch named Zlochevsky, I think it was self-dealing, awarding himself contracts. When was that?
To the best of my knowledge, he was Minister of Ecology under President Yanukovych from 2010 to 2012. And at the time, licenses to have substrata exploration of gas were awarded by a subdivision of the Ministry of Ecology.
So this corrupt self-dealing then was approximately 7 years, at least 7 years before the events that bring us here today, the phone call on the 25th and the events around it?
Correct. His time as minister was 2010 to 2012. Hunter Biden joined the board of Burisma in 2014.
And you've read the call transcript, have you not?
I have, and I have it in front of me, but I haven't read it for about a month.
Is there any mention in the discussion with President Trump and President Zelensky of this oligarch, Zlochevsky, who 7 years earlier had been self-dealing?
To the best of my knowledge, no.
Is there a discussion of awarding contracts to oneself or the corrupt acts in the 2012 to 2014 timeframe?
To the best of my knowledge, no.
No, what the president brings up is CrowdStrike, the server, and the Bidens. Am I right?
I see that here, yes.
There was no discussion on that call of setting up an anti-corruption court or looking into corruption among oligarchs or companies in general. The president's comments were focused on two things, 2016 and the Bidens. Am I right?
I believe so, yes.
Now, you testified in your opening statement, I do not believe the United States should ask other countries to engage in selective politically associated investigations or prosecutions against opponents of those in power, because such selective actions undermine the rule of law regardless of the country. The selective politically associated investigations or prosecutions against opponents of those in power, are you referring to the Bidens there?
I'm referring as a general principle about the promotion of the rule of law.
But that would apply to the President of the United States seeking an investigation of his political opponent, would it not?
It could be interpreted that way, yes, sir.
And I take it in your discussions, Ambassador Taylor, with Ambassador Sondland or others, what was communicated to you was that the President wanted investigations into 2016 and the Bidens, not into an oligarch named Zelensky or self-dealing, but 2016 and the Bidens. Was that your understanding?
That was my understanding.
And in fact, when you said your staff overheard this call between Ambassador Sondland and the President, in that call, the President brings up investigation, does he not?
He did.
And immediately after the President gets off the phone with Sondland, Sondland is asked by your staff, what does the President think about Ukraine? And his answer is, he's just interested in the Bidens, am I right?
He said he was more interested in the Bidens.
More interested in the Bidens. No discussion of Zelensky or Chalupa or things that happened 7 years ago. He was interested in the Bidens.
Yes, sir.
Now, I think you also testified that Ambassador Sondland told you that President Trump wanted Zelensky in a public box. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And by public box, did that mean that private statements, private promises to do this investigation of 2016 of the Bidens were not enough? He had to go on TV. He had to go public in some way because the President wanted him in that box. Is that your understanding?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know exactly what he had in mind, and I'm not sure what Ambassador Sondland had in mind, who was the one who mentioned that to me. That's the implication. The implication was it needed to be public as opposed to being a private assurance.
And I think you said in that same call, you asked Ambassador Sondland to push back on President Trump's demand. Is that right?
That's correct, sir.
So you understood from your conversation with Sondland this was the President's demand, not Sondland's demand, the President's demand, and you wanted Sondland to push back. Am I right?
What I wanted to, so Ambassador Sondland was clearly able to have conversations with the President, and I thought that the pressure on another president, on President Zelensky, was not a good idea from either president's standpoint. So I suggested in that phone call to with Ambassador Sondland that he, since he regularly or frequently had conversation with the president, could make that point.
Well, and I think the way you express yourself is you wanted Sondland to push back on President Trump's demand, right?
Yes, sir.
So as you understand from talking to Sondland, this is what the president wanted him to do, and you wanted Sondland to push back.
I asked Ambassador Sondland to push back. That's correct.
And in fact, even after the aid was ultimately released, even after the White House learns of the whistleblower complaint and the congressional investigation, the aid is released, even after those events, you were still worried that Zelensky was going to feel it necessary to go on CNN and announce these investigations, were you not?
Mr. Chairman, I was still worried that he might do that. So, yes, I thought that would be a bad idea. And so when there was some indication that there might still be a plan for the CNN interview in New York, which was upcoming, at the United Nations General Assembly meeting, I was worried. I wanted to be sure that that didn't happen, so I addressed it with the Zelensky staff.
And I think you said earlier that Dan Liuk, the national security advisor then for Zelensky, was concerned Zelensky didn't want to be used as some tool in American politics. Is that right?
That's correct, sir.
So Zelensky didn't want to go on TV to announce political investigations that he thought would mire him in U.S. politics, right?
He knew that he and his advisors knew that it's a bad idea to interject, to interfere in other nations' elections. Yes,
but,
sir.
But nonetheless, it appeared until the aid was lifted, the hold was lifted, that he felt compelled to do it.
He was making plans, his staff was making plans to have him make some kind of announcement, I don't know what it would have been, on CNN in public.
Even though he didn't want to be marred in U.S. politics?
Even though he knew it was a bad idea to interfere in other people's elections.
Mr. Nunes, you are recognized for 7 minutes and 10 seconds.
Thank the gentleman for that. Ambassador Taylor, you said in your deposition that the first time you heard about this issue with Rudy Giuliani, and I'm paraphrasing, but you read it in the New York Times. Is that correct?
I do remember that. I do remember noticing about Mr. Giuliani being involved in this in that article. Yes, sir.
Okay. I think one of the mothers of all conspiracy theories is that somehow the President of the United States would want a country that he doesn't even like, he doesn't want to give foreign aid to have the Ukrainians start an investigation into Biden's. With that, I yield to Mr. Jordan.
Thank the gentleman for yielding. Ambassador Taylor, thank you for being here. Aid's held up on July 18th, is that right?
That's when I first heard about it, Mr.
Then it's released, Ambassador Taylor, on September 11th. And we know that from your deposition, in those 55 days that aid is delayed, you met with President Zelensky 3 times. The first one was July 26th, the day after the famous call now between President Trump and President Zelensky. President Zelensky meets with you, Ambassador Volker, and Ambassador Sondland. And again, according to your deposition, your testimony, there was no linkage of security assistance dollars to investigating Burisma or the Bidens. Second meeting is August 27th. Again, in this 55-day time frame, second meeting is August 27th. President Zelensky meets with you and Ambassador Bolton and others. And again, there's no linkage of dollars, security assistance dollars, to an investigation of the Bidens. Then, of course, the third meeting is September 5th. President Zelensky meets with you and Senators Johnson and Murphy. And once again, there was no linkage of security assistance dollars to an investigation of Burisma or the Bidens. 3 meetings with the president of Ukraine, the new president, and no linkage. That's accurate?
Ms. Jordan, it's certainly accurate on the first two meetings, because to my knowledge, the Ukrainians were not aware of the hold on assistance until the 29th of August.
So the political article.
The third meeting that you mentioned with the Senators Murphy and Senator Johnson, there was discussion of the security assistance, but
no linkage.
But there was not discussion of linkage.
3 meetings, face-to-face, with President Zelensky, no linkage. Yet, in your deposition, you said this, and you said it again the first hour of the majority. My clear understanding was security assistance money would not come until President Zelensky committed to pursue the investigation. My clear understanding was they weren't going to get the money until President Zelensky committed to pursue the investigations. Now, with all due respect, Ambassador, your clear understanding was obviously wrong, because it didn't happen. President Zelensky didn't announce he was going to investigate Burisma or the Bidens. He didn't do a press conference and say, I'm going to investigate the Bidens, we're going to investigate Burisma. He didn't tweet about it, and you just told the ranking member he didn't do the CNN interview and announce he's going to investigate Burisma or the Bidens. So 3 face-to-face meetings, it doesn't come up, no linkage whatsoever. President Zelensky doesn't announce it before the aid is released on the 11th. And yet you said you have a clear understanding that those 2 things were going to happen. The money was going to get released, but not until there was an investigation, and that, in fact, didn't happen. So what I'm wondering is, where did you get this clear understanding?
As I testified, Ms. Jordan, this came from Ambassador Sondland.
Well, can you hold 1 second, Ambassador? I'm going to bring you a piece of paper from Ambassador Sondland's statement.
Very good.
And you can take a look at this. Go ahead, though. I want to let you finish.
So, Mr. Jordan, should I read this or?
No, I just want you to have it because I'm going to read it.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, but I want you to go ahead and finish. You said, Ambassador, you got this from Ambassador Sondland.
That is correct. Ambassador Sondland also said that he talked to President Zelensky and Mr. Yermak and had told them that although this was not a quid pro quo, if President Zelensky did not clear things up in public, we would be at a stalemate. That was one point. It was also the case.
Mr. Morrison talked to you, right?
No. What I was going to say is Ambassador Sondland also told me that he recognized that it was a mistake to have told the Ukrainians that only the meeting with the president in the Oval Office was held up on the in order to get these investigations. No, it was not just the beating, it was also the security system. That is, everything was. So those two discussions.
No, I understand.
Okay.
All right, so again, just to recap, you had three meetings with President Zelensky. No linkage in those three meetings came up. Ambassador Zelensky didn't announce that he was going to do any investigation of the Bidens or Burismas before the aid was released. He didn't do a tweet, didn't do anything on CNN, didn't do any of that. President Zelensky, excuse me. And then what you have in front of you is an addendum that Mr. Sondland made to his testimony that we got a couple weeks ago. It says, Declaration of Ambassador Gordon Sondland. I, Gordon Sondland, do hereby swear and affirm as follows. I want you to look at point number two, bullet point number two, second sentence. Ambassador Taylor recalls that Mr. Morrison told Ambassador Taylor that I told Mr. Morrison that I conveyed this message to Mr. Yermak on September 1st, 2019, in connection with Vice President Pence's visit to Warsaw and a meeting with President Zelensky. Now, this is his clarification. Let me read it one more time. Ambassador Taylor recalls that Mr. Morrison told Ambassador Taylor that I told Mr. Morrison that I conveyed this message to Mr. Yermak on September 1st, 2019, in connection with Vice President Pence's visit to Warsaw and a meeting with President Zelensky. We got six people having four conversations in one sentence, and you just told me this is where you got your clear understanding. Which, I mean, even though you had three opportunities with President Zelensky for him to tell you, you know what? We're going to do these investigations to get the aid. Didn't tell you three different times. Never makes an announcement. Never tweets about it. Never does a CNN interview. Ambassador, you weren't on the call, were you? The president, you didn't listen on President Trump's call and President Zelensky's call?
I did not.
You never talked with Chief of Staff Mulvaney?
I never did.
You never met the president?
That's correct.
You had three meetings again with Zelensky and it didn't come up.
And two of those they had never heard about as far as I know.
And President
there was no reason for it.
President Zelensky never made an announcement. This is what I can't believe. And you're their star witness. You're their first witness.
You're the guy
based on this, based on, I mean, I've seen church prayer chains that are easier to understand than this. Ambassador Taylor recalls that Mr. Morrison told, now again, this is, I hereby swear and affirm from Gordon Sondland. Ambassador Taylor recalls that Mr. Morrison told Ambassador Taylor that I told Mr. Morrison that I conveyed this message to Mr. Yermak on September 1st, 20. This all happens, by the way, in Warsaw, where Vice President Pence meets with President Zelensky. And guess what?
Taylor,
they didn't talk about any linkage either.
Time of the gentleman's expired. Ambassador Taylor, would you like to respond?
The only response, two responses, Mr. Chairman, thank you, and Mr. Jordan, glad to take those questions. Let me just say that I don't consider myself a star witness for anything.
They do. You don't.
No,
do.
I don't. I'm responding to your questions.
Don't interrupt the witness.
I think I was clear about I'm not here to take one side or the other or to advocate any particular outcome. So let me just restate that. Second thing is that my understanding is only coming from people that I talk to.
We got that.
I think this clarification from Ambassador Sondland was because he said he didn't remember this in his first deposition. So he wanted to kind of clarify. But I think, Mr. Jordan, the way I read this, he remembers it the same way I do.
Yeah, and it's real clear, right?
It's very clear to me.
Thank you. Thank you, Ambassador Taylor. Mr. Himes, you're recognized for 5 minutes.
Live from the Capitol, the first impeachment hearing before the House Intelligence Committee featuring two career diplomats, Bill Taylor and George Kent. Taylor testified today that President Trump was overheard asking about the investigations he wanted Ukraine to pursue in exchange for the release of American aid, and that is central to the Democratic narrative, that President Trump used the power of his office to pressure Ukrainian officials for personal political gain. You heard Republicans work to counter the Democratic narrative by portraying Taylor and Kent as peripheral figures and suggesting the president had legitimate concerns about Ukraine beyond his own reelection. I'm Aaron Katursky. You're listening to live coverage from ABC News. Straight back live to the Capitol, ABC's Inez de la Quintera. What strikes you, Inez?
Yeah, so we saw Republican Congressman Devin Nunes and his counsel zeroing in on two big points. So one, there were lots of questions for Kent and Taylor that had to do with Hunter Biden and whether he was qualified enough to be appointed to the board of Burisma, that Ukrainian company. Kent and Taylor responded that they couldn't answer that. They just didn't know. But this was Republicans essentially trying to show that there was a reason here why President Trump wanted Hunter Biden investigated, and this idea that Trump wanted corruption more broadly speaking, investigating, although Democrats just countered that in their follow-up questioning, and they made it clear that the administration still hasn't been able to point to any investigations that were conducted in Ukraine that did not involve the president's political opponents. And then the second big point that Republicans made was arguing that these irregular channels when it came to policymaking in Ukraine were, quote, not as outlandish as they could be, to which Bill Taylor kind of laughed and shrugged, and that was a moment in which Republicans were trying to justify why people like Rudy Giuliani and Rick Perry were involved when it came to policymaking in Ukraine, even though they were not a part of that official channel, and that official channel being the State Department. And then finally, now we are seeing just now Congressman Jim Jordan talking about hearsay, this idea that neither diplomat, whether it is, you know, Taylor or Kent, that neither of them had firsthand knowledge of what happened here and had no direct conversations with President Trump.
Inez de la Quintera live with us from Capitol Hill as this hearing now is poised to continue for the next couple of hours. I want to turn to ABC News political analyst Steve Roberts. At the beginning, the Democrats tried to make their case. Then the Republicans, Steve, sought to undercut it. Did they do it?
No, I don't think so. I think they tried to muddy the waters. They really cannot deny that these conversations took place. What they're trying to say in many ways is that these it was justified, that the president had a justified reason for inquiring about corruption in Ukraine, justified reason for asking questions about Ukrainian involvement in the 2016 election. And this is all designed to muddy the waters, to cloud the argument. I don't think they were terribly effective, but that is the strategy. I would make another quick point, and that is while they keep just at the end, the question was raised, well, you only have secondhand knowledge. But it's the administration who's blocking people who have firsthand knowledge from appearing. They've resisted subpoenas. They've resisted attempts to summon other witnesses. They've tried repeatedly to stop people like Mick Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff, from appearing on Capitol Hill. So it's at best pretty disingenuous to say, oh, well, the witnesses you have only have secondhand information, but we're not going to allow the witnesses who do have firsthand information from testifying, Aaron.
ABC News political analyst Steve Roberts with us as this Intelligence Committee hearing continues now. We understand that President Trump says he did not watch the first part of the hearing. He's now with the president of Turkey. ABC's Karen Travers asked the president about that today in the Oval Office, and she's with us now from her post at the White House. Karen.
Aaron, the president said he was too busy to watch it, and then he added that it's a witch hunt, it's a hoax, I'm too busy to watch it. I asked him if he had been briefed on what had taken place in the first couple of hours of the House Intelligence Committee hearing, and he said he had not been, but added, there's nothing there. He did note that he was paying attention to the lawyers being involved in this. He was criticizing what he called television lawyers. I think it's also notable there were tweets coming from his account about the hearing during that first one or two hours, but staff sometimes do tweet from the president's account. I have to say, it's pretty quiet here today. The president's now going to spend the afternoon in meetings with Turkey's President Erdogan before his press conference, but we were told there was going to be a robust operation of pushback from within inside the White House. Press team, lawyers, and legislative affairs, people all going through this hearing and giving the president's defense. We haven't really gotten a lot of that, and it's striking then to then also see the president not on Twitter. So it's been kind of quiet here, surprising.
Somebody who was on Twitter, though, was the press secretary, and she took aim at the two witnesses.
Yeah, Stephanie Grisham, the president's press secretary, who's not a household name because she does not do briefings, has not had one yet. She's active on Twitter and wrote just a few moments ago that the Democrats' star witnesses can't provide any firsthand knowledge of any wrongdoing by the president. She says their testimony contradicts this false quid pro quo narrative, which that I'm not quite sure what part she was talking about there. But she notes here they are essentially two bureaucrats with a foreign policy gripe. We've heard this before from Republican allies of the president, that these are people who do not support the president's agenda to push Ukraine to tackle corruption, and that these are people who are never Trumpers. You have to remember, though, that Bill Taylor, whose testimony has been happening now for hours, was picked to do this. He was offered the job by the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. The president a couple weeks ago said, well, maybe Pompeo made a mistake, but he is still the current top diplomat to Ukraine. The president has not pulled him out of this position. I asked him last week, why not? And he said, so far, everybody had been fine in their testimony behind closed doors. Sorry about that. We're getting an announcement from the White House here.
No worries. ABC's Karen Travers with us live from the White House. And I want to pull Rick Klein, our political director, into the conversation for his thoughts about how this is all playing. This has now gone on for about 4 hours. Rick, we've certainly learned some new things. The narrative seemed clear. How's this going
to
play?
Well, the facts are not in dispute. What's in open to interpretation is what you do about those facts, whether they're indeed impeachable facts that are in evidence. I'm struck by how witness after witness, through private and now public testimony, are all pointing in the same direction. And it really isn't a direction that Republicans are seeking to refute. What they're trying to do instead is to recast this as a foreign policy disagreement, and a legitimate disagreement between a newly elected president who is breaking a lot of China in the foreign policy establishment. And viewed through that lens, which I think is a selective reading of the history at best, but viewed from that lens, the president's actions suddenly seem quite defensible, quite understandable. Absent that, you have sufficient evidence built through today and through days and weeks worth of other testimony and other evidence that all say that the president did, in fact, pressure the Ukrainians to deliver something that he wanted for political purposes. And again, there's a different threshold question about impeachability, but my sense is that you're not going to change a lot of minds given the fact that the narrative has been as established as it was and the defense is as limited as it is.
Rick Klein, our political director here at ABC News. The Democrats and Republicans will keep at it with Ambassador Taylor and State Department official George Kent. The first of several public hearings to unfold in the impeachment inquiry over the next 2 weeks as the ultimate check on an American president now unfolds in the hands of a deeply divided Congress with we the people bearing witness. I'm Aaron Katursky. You've been listening to live coverage from ABC News.
ABC News, honored winner of 4 Edward R. Murrow Awards. ABC News, America's number one news choice.